Let me just talk about first about the necessity to speak out, to speak your mind, whatever your mind is, whatever you think, but the necessity to speak out, because in a time like this, in a time of war, it becomes a time of war as soon as the president says it's a time of war, and as soon as the media says it's a time of war, even if Congress has not declared war, as the Constitution requires. But, you know, the Constitution has been ignored for so long, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. Law does not. I used to teach a course called Law and Justice in America. Taught it for many years. And the theme of the course was, it doesn't matter what the law says. It matters who has the power, really. So, yeah, the Constitution can say, oh, Congress must declare war. It doesn't matter. Ever since the end of World War II, we have been in war after war after war. Without Congress declaring war, it's okay. As they say, we are a nation of laws. Yeah. I'm concerned with our taking the initiative to speak out, even though a certain blanket of intimidation has been spread across the country. I mean, am I exaggerating? Isn't it intimidating when everybody in high political circles and people in the higher reaches of the media, when they all cry for unity and supporting the president, and where, you know, editors of the New Republic say, well, if the people on the left who oppose the war may be considered as a fifth column. Do you know what a fifth column is? It goes back to the Spanish Civil War. The fifth column was a column of traitors. People working from inside to overthrow, you see. That was the fifth column. And so people may be considered traitors for speaking out. So the word is unity and support the president, and the major television commentators all talk in that way, and the television programs are festooned with flags. Now, I know flags can mean something nice and gentle and good. They can. But there are times when flags have a kind of unmistakable aura that bespeaks drums and bugles and war and support for war. And there's something intimidating about that omnipresent symbol. And then you have Dan Rather, Anchorman. What is he anchored to? He's anchored to the establishment. That's what an anchorman is. And he says on national television, Bush is my president. When he says, get in line, I ask, where? Well, this is strange. Here he is, independent journalism. And the idea of journalism is to be an independent voice, an independent critic, not a handmaiden of government, but somebody who represents the public and who inspects the government and does not immediately say, yeah, we're together. And when the president says get in line, I get in line too. No. That's what happens in a totalitarian state, not in a democracy, you see. A kind of spurious unity, you know. And Gore. Do you remember Gore? Gore said, Bush is my commander-in-chief. Really? He He hasn't read the Constitution lately. The Constitution says the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He's not the commander-in-chief of us, you see. No, really. You know. And it seems to me it's the essence of democracy for people not to get in line if they don't want to get in line, not to listen to the president as if he's our commander-in-chief, and to think independently and do independently what we want. That's what democracy is. And that democracy is being attacked on all sides by this great atmosphere of intimidation that's created. I mean, I spoke about 2 weeks ago at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore to a crowd not quite as big as this, because nothing is as big as this, you see. You know, but it was a big crowd, but, you know, but Baltimore is not Burlington, you know. You know, but, and this had been, my talk there had been planned for weeks, months before, part of a series of talks with different speakers. The speaker just preceding me was Oliver North. And the theme of this series of lectures was, because it was supposedly about multiculturalism and things, was a nation divided. That was the theme, a nation divided. Multicultural? Oliver North speaking about multiculturalism? Well, I didn't ask, you know. But a nation divided. But by the time I got there, they had gone over every printed program and crossed out the word, a nation divided was the program. They crossed out the word divided and put in the word united. Yes, they say, in times of war, the nation must be united, which, of course, begs the question. Yeah, but why should we be at war? And yet we have a long tradition in this country of stifling dissent exactly at those moments when dissent is badly needed. That is, when it's a matter of life and death. You know, I mean, this has been, you know, Congress, you know, passes a Sedition Act in 1798, and then, and again, World War I, passes a Sedition Act, and an Espionage Act, Sedition Act, 1917, 1918, they send 1,000 people to jail, and all of that. I mean, it's, yes, historically, that's what happens. And not only does Congress pass such laws, but the Supreme Court affirms them, which is very odd, because the job of the Supreme Court, at least I learned this in junior high school, and, you learn in junior high school what democracy is. Democracy is what we have. Democracy is the three branches of government. Democracy is checks and balances. In fact, they put democracy up on the blackboard. Make a diagram, legislative, executive, judicial. And then they draw the lines to show you the checks and balances, and then you're sitting there as a junior high school student feeling really good and proud that we have checks and balances. Because it means then, you know, if something, one branch of government does something bad, it will be checked by the other branch. And that way, nothing bad can happen. Well, you know, there's what they put on the board in junior high school, and then there is historical reality. And historical reality is that although it's the job of the Supreme Court to see if, in fact, Congress has violated the First Amendment to the Constitution, which says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, if it's the job of the Supreme Court to see if Congress has violated the First Amendment, well, the Supreme Court has failed in its job again and again. They failed in 1798, and they failed in 1917-18 when they put Eugene Debs and 1,000 other people in jail for speaking out against the war. And they, you know, they amended the First Amendment. Say, well, Yes, the First Amendment says this, but. There's no but in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. No but, you see. Well, the but was, well, if there's a clear and present danger. Well, actually, it sort of makes sense. Look, if there's a clear and present danger, well, maybe there are times, you know, when you can't allow full freedom of speech because of a clear and present danger. Well, what was the clear and present danger that the Supreme Court was dealing with at that moment when they were making this decision? The clear and present danger was a guy distributing leaflets on the streets of New York opposing the draft. He was a clear and present danger to the nation. Now, after the war, more people began to think, no, Woodrow Wilson was a clear and present danger to the nation, you see. And but there's this irony that it's exactly when you need free speech, exactly when it's the lives of young people who might be in the armed forces are at stake, the lives of people overseas who may be the victims of our armed action, their lives are at stake. Exactly when it's a matter of life and death, that's when you should shut up. Exactly when you need it most. So you have free speech for trivial issues, and you have no free speech for life and death issues, and that's called democracy. No, we can't accept that. See? No. So we have a responsibility to speak out, to speak our minds, especially now. And no matter what they say, and no matter how they cry for unity and supporting the president and getting in line, we have a democratic responsibility as citizens to speak out and say what we want to say. And one of the things we need to do is to take a look at history. And yes, take a look at history, because history might be useful in helping us understand what is going on. And we have to take a look at history because no one else is taking a look at history. The president isn't giving us history, and the media aren't giving us history. They never do. I mean, here we have this incredibly complex, technologically developed media, but you don't get the history that you need to understand, you know, what is going on today. Well, there's a kind of history they will give you, because history cannot only be used for good purposes. History can be abused. And so history is abused, you know, as when you create an analogy, you know, which will immediately put people on your side without thinking about it. You say, Pearl Harbor. It's like Pearl Harbor. Well, since we went to war at Pearl Harbor, it's very obvious, you know, now it's like Pearl Harbor, therefore we've got to go to war. Well, please, you know, how many, really, is this like Pearl Harbor? Is this the situation? Is there an identifiable nation out there, you know, which has attacked us, you see, and which therefore, if attacked back, will stop attacking us? Is there a nation out there which is expanding its power, you know, in Asia, and Hitler expanding his power? You know, the World War II analogy, you know, is always brought up. You know, is, you know, that's not this situation. This is different. It's funny, they keep telling us, this is a very different situation, but they're not willing to recognize that this is a different situation than World War II. This is a very specific and this very unique situation, and it has to be discussed in its specificity, you see. But that doesn't mean to say that there are not things we can learn from history which might throw some light on this. Just throw light on it. I mean, history can't give you definitive, positive answers to the issues that come up today. History can't do that. But it can suggest things. It can suggest skepticism about certain things. It can suggest probabilities and possibilities, leaving to you then, once you have arrange the probabilities and the possibilities. They can leave it to you then to see what applies to this particular situation, what historical experience can throw light on what has happened. So, yeah, I would suggest there are some things you can learn from historical experience. One thing you can learn is that there's a history of deception of the public by the government in times of war, or just before war, or to get us into war. A long history of that. Going back to the Mexican War, when Polk lied to the nation about what was happening on the border, you know, between Nueces River and the Rio Grande River, and boom, boom, they fired on, you know, shed blood on America, you know, really. Polk wanted California. And that was it. Before there was any clash on the border, he wanted California. He wanted a war with Mexico. He coveted Mexican territory. And in fact, we fought a war with Mexico and took half of Mexico. Okay. Again and again, lies told on the eve of war. You know, lies told before World War I. Lies told before the Spanish-American War. The battleship Maine, they've sunk it. You know, in Havana Harbor, the Spaniards did it. Boom, we go to war. Nobody knew who sunk the battleship Maine. And many, many years later, there's a Navy investigating team under Admiral Rickover, and they find out that the battleship Maine was sunk by an engine defect. Right. But it's too late to take back. The truth is, we weren't really interested in the battleship Maine. We were interested in Cuba, not liberating Cuba from Spain. Well, no, I should. Yeah, there's half truth to that. Yes, we wanted to liberate Cuba from Spain, but not from us, you see. Get Spain out, get us in. And then there's another lie told shortly after that when we go to war in the Philippines. In the history books, you have a little bit of, you have a lot of space on the Spanish-American War because Theodore Roosevelt is involved, and Theodore Roosevelt is one of our heroes, and he wrote up San Juan Hill, and there were the Rough Riders. And, you know, this is what you learn. In the history books, the Spanish-American War, great, great victory. Takes up a lot of space. Philippine War takes up a little bit of space. Spanish-American War lasts 3 months, quick, short war. The Philippine War lasts years and years, full of bloody atrocities committed by the American armed forces in the Philippines. Not the splendid little war that our Secretary of War described in Cuba. No, this is an ugly, bloody war, precursor of Vietnam and the massacres that took place. At the very end of the Philippine War, and lies are told about how the Philippine War started. Of course, there are American troops in the Philippines. You might ask, what are American troops doing in the Philippines? Well, don't ask questions like that. American troops belong anywhere where we want them to be, you know. But what are they there for? They're there so we can take the Philippines. But the Filipinos want to take the Philippines. Sorry, they're not Christians. They're heathens. They're, you know, they're ignorant people. You know, we deserve to have the Philippines. So if they want to fight us, they'll have to fight us for years and years and endure maybe 800,000, a million dead in the Philippines. Really? Have you heard that in your history books? But war, lies. You know, at the end of near the very end of the Philippine War, 1906, army troops, a regiment of the U.S. Army massacres 600 Moros, Muslim people on a southern island in the Philippines, massacres men, women, and children. I mean, these people are living in the Stone Age. They have no modern weapons. They're mowed down, 600 of them, every last one of them, man, woman, and child. And Theodore Roosevelt sends a message to the commanding general congratulating him on his military victory. Whereupon Mark Twain, not believing in national unity at a time like this, and not believing that he must go along, Mark Twain denounces Theodore Roosevelt for this. But see, But there Theodore Roosevelt is up on Mount Rushmore. What can we do about that? It's hard. He's a hero. Of such stuff are our heroes made. But lies told about World War I, lies told again and again. I mean, just to rush more recently, remember, Vietnam War starts with a lie about the Gulf of Tonkin. Statements made to the American people immediately, you know, our destroyers have been attacked by North Vietnamese PT boats in the Gulf of Tonkin, and zoom, Congress rushes to pass, just as they did now, right? I mean, Congress has always been a bunch of absolute sheep when it comes to matters of war. You cannot depend. Talk about the three branches of government and checks and balances and Congress acting as a check on the president. Forget it. The president wants war. We go to war, and the congressmen all line up like the Supreme Soviet. And I always think of Congress as the Supreme Soviet when I see the president making a State of the Union address, and they get up every 3 minutes and cheer, all of them, Democrats and Republicans. And I think, my God, is this a democracy? No, that's not it. But there, after the Gulf of Tonkin, immediately after the president says, oh, this is what they did to us, which then turns out to be full of lies, really. After that, immediately Congress passes almost unanimously in the House, two dissenting votes in the Senate, giving the president full authority to do what he wants in the Gulf of Tonkin, and soon we are at war for 9 years with 58,000 American dead and 2 million Vietnamese dead. And so we just saw that same spectacle reenacted where this terrible thing happens, this terrorist act happens in New York, and Washington and Bush goes before Congress, and there's no need to think and no need to ask questions about what we should do. They vote, right, unanimously in the Senate, almost unanimously in the House. Oh, I saw there was one dissenting vote, and I thought, oh, that must be Bernie Sanders. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was Barbara Lee. Deception. The history of deception by government has been going on for a long time. Some of you may have heard of the journalist I.F. Stone. He was one of the great journalists of the 20th century. He worked for mainstream newspapers and then decided, he couldn't print what he wanted, couldn't write what he wanted, so he set up his own little newsletter, and he would gather all sorts of information from all sorts of places that nobody else was printing, and he'd put them out in his newsletter, and soon people understood, if you want to get stuff that the major newspapers don't give you and that the government doesn't give you, go to I.F. Stone's newsletter. So he became a famous journalist of our time, and he would go and speak to journalism classes, speak to young people who were going to be reporters, and he would say, look, I'm going to tell you a number of things about being a reporter, but of all the things I'm going to tell you, just remember two words. Governments lie. It's a good starting point. Yeah. I'm not saying governments always lie. No, they don't always lie. But it's a good idea to start off with the assumption that governments lie, and that therefore whatever they say, especially when it comes to matters of war and foreign policy, because when it's a matter of domestic policy, there are things you might be able to check up on because it's here in this country. When something's happening very far, it's very, people don't know very much about foreign policy. We depend on them, because they're supposed to know. They have the experts. Well, we learned during Vietnam about what it means to depend on them and the White House and their experts and their Phi Beta Kappas and, advising a president, the Harvard, Yale, and Princeton people all around the president. How could you get more intelligent than that, you see? You examine closely. One of the things I examine closely is when the government says, we're only bombing military targets, you say. That's an old story, real old story. We're only bombing military targets. There's a half-truth to that. You may aim at military targets, but it's in the nature of bombing that if you aim at military targets, that a good part of the time your bombs will fall on places near military targets where people live, or sometimes even far away from military targets where people live, maybe a mile away from military targets. And this is with the smartest of bombs. No such thing as a smart bomb. Remember they're telling us about smart bombs in the Gulf War? It turned out that 85% of them were dumb. There's no such thing as a smart bomb. And they say military, in the Vietnam War, they kept saying again and again, oh, we're bombing military targets. Blatant lies. I mean, that was even going beyond when you're aiming at military targets and you're hitting at other things, but they were actually aiming at things which were not military targets, because when you're dealing with a third world country that has really very few military targets, you run out of military targets and you start bombing everything else. And so in Vietnam, we bombed schools, we bombed hospitals, we bombed everything we could possibly see, you see. And this happened more recently, and in the Gulf War, with this military targets. Well, water supply, people who don't have water die. the whole infrastructure, right? Because you run out of specifically military targets. And then there are times when the government says something is a military target and it really isn't. I don't know if any of you remember this, but there was this one point in the Gulf War, in the middle of February, 1991, the United States dropped a bomb on an air raid shelter in Baghdad. Now, they could have said, it's an accident, we didn't mean to hit the air raid shelter. There were 500 or 600 people inside the air raid shelter, huddled there, because you go to air raid shelters to escape bombs. Now, of course, if you understood that these bombs were smart and they would only hit military targets, you wouldn't have to go to an air raid shelter. But people go to air raid shelters, or they go run away, or they do something, because they somehow have the notion that the bombs are not only going to hit military targets. So they huddle in this air raid shelter, and a bomb dropped on this air raid shelter, and 500, 600 people are killed. And the United States does not say this is an accident. The United States said, we bombed that because it was a communications site. What does that mean? Reporters going into the air raid shelter almost immediately after, from Reuters, Agence France-Presse, newspaper, went in, no sign of any possible thing that could possibly be military. See? So you have to be very careful when the government said we're bombing military targets, et cetera, et cetera. I emphasize this because we have to understand what we are doing in Afghanistan to end terrorism, because we need to end terrorism. We absolutely need to end terrorism. We have to, yes. And we have to begin to think about what we need to do to end terrorism. And we have to think about whether bombing Afghanistan is going to end terrorism, And because, how much thinking went into this? How much thinking went into this? You think, there are all these minds. It doesn't matter how many minds you have, it's the quality of mind. that counts. And it's also, you know, the morality of these minds and the understanding of these minds that there may be people in other countries who deserve to live as much as those people in the Twin Towers deserve to live. No, that's... No. No. So, well, people say, yeah, but you must do something. I agree. You know, people say, you can't do nothing. I agree. You must do something. I like the logic. You must do something. Therefore, bomb. I don't get it. I mean, that's the only possible thing you can do if you must do something? Medical students, you know, confronted, you know, if somebody has a leg infection, they don't know what to do about it. Amputate. The medical students take the oath of Hippocrates. You don't know what to do. Something is bad, really bad. You must do something. But the first rule is do no harm. Let's just have to start off with that. You do no harm. We are doing great harm. Great harm, you see. And if you think we're not, try to imagine and say, well, you know, we're not killing that many people. We're not killing that many people. We don't know how many people we're killing. First of all, because you can't believe the government. I'm not saying you can believe the Taliban. No, all governments lie, right? But it's just a matter of common sense and knowing the history of bombing that we know, and just in the little reports that come through, even through the filter of control and so on, you know, there were reporters, you know, in villages in Afghanistan reporting, and there they were, right on the spot, and there are these houses destroyed, and there is these freshly dug graves, and there is a man who lost his wife and four kids in a bombing, and there, and there's some things are admitted, just a Red Cross compound was hit, right, on the same day that Bush is asking people to contribute to the Red Cross. Well, if you're going to, we're going to contribute to the Red Cross, first assure us that you're not going to bomb the Red Cross, you see. And if you think we're, you know, what we're doing in Afghanistan is, you know, it's not very much, you know. Consider that there are hundreds of thousands of people in Afghanistan who are fleeing the cities and towns in which they live. Have you seen the pictures of Afghan refugees? It started as soon as Bush promised to bomb, because there are certain American promises they can count on, you see. And that's one of them. And the refugees immediately began moving. And so you see the pictures of these families with all their possessions, or as many of their possessions they carry on their backs, and their wagons and their kids, and hundreds of thousands of them. So this isn't a small thing. This isn't just, oh, we're killing a few people and that's a price we're willing to pay. We are terrorizing Afghanistan. I'm not exaggerating. The people who are in Kabul and people in other places in Afghanistan have to live with the fear of these bombs. Have you lived under bombs? Do you know what it's? Can you imagine what it's like? And you're in a very backward, technologically, right, undeveloped country, and there are these monster machines coming over with this ferocious noise and the lights and the flashing and the explosions. And it's, yes, we're terrorizing people in Afghanistan. And it's not right to respond to the fact that we have been terrorized as we have. Not right to respond to that by terrorizing other people. Absolutely wrong, you see. You know. Yeah. And furthermore, it's not going to help. And you can say, well, maybe it may be worth doing because this will end terrorism. I mean, how much common sense does it take to know that you cannot end terrorism by indiscriminately just throwing bombs on Afghanistan? And then, of course, you get a report, we have now destroyed three of their camps, so we've destroyed four. Who are you kidding? How many hours does it take to set up a training camp? How easy it is to move from one place to another? I mean, the history of bombing is mostly a history of futility. Yes, really. You know, there's a book that came out recently called A History of Bombing. And this bombing, oh, and I was a bombardier. And sure, the technology has improved, although it was claimed, even then, it was claimed our bombs are smart because we're using this special bomb site, this Norden bomb site. People really believe that. Even we believe that, we who are using the bomb site. Because we would bomb at 11,000 feet to 4,000 feet, and we got pretty close to the target. But then when we flew on missions, we were bombing at 30,000 feet, and the bombs went all over the place and killed an awful lot of people, all sorts of people. You know, it didn't matter. I say it didn't matter because these people were ciphers. Who are these people? I didn't even see them. You bomb another country, you don't see these people. You're bombing from high altitudes. You know, our planes are bombing at high altitudes because they want to escape anti-aircraft fire, right? No, you don't see anything on the ground. You see flashes and you see explosions and you may take pictures, but you don't hear screams. You don't see blood. You don't see severed limbs. You don't see any of that. We saw that in New York. We saw those scenes in New York. They horrified us. We saw people in panic running from those explosions, that enormous pile of debris, you know, and we were horrified. These were real people to us. But then, if we bomb other countries, those people are not real to us. One of the things I thought of after I got over my initial horror at what happened in New York, I thought, hey, that's what it must have been like when I was bombing in Europe. That's what it must have been like, and I didn't even know it, because these people were ciphers to me, you see. And then I thought, maybe to these terrorists, that's what it is for them. Oh, 6,000 human beings, you know, no, they have a mission. They have a goal. They're not human beings to terrorists. And people in other parts of the world have not been human beings to us. And if there's anything we might get out of this experience, is that we might take that horror that we have felt looking at those scenes in New York and the compassion that we have felt for the people who endured this and their families, and extend this to people in other parts of the world who have been enduring this for a very long time. And that does mean examining the United States and our policies. You know, when you do that, when you suggest that, say, you know, I think maybe we ought to look at ourselves and our policies. There's people say, oh, you're justifying what happened. No, absolutely not. To explain is not to justify. But if you don't want to explain anything, you will never learn anything. So you have to understand, you have to explain without justifying. And you have to look, yes, you have to dig down and see if you can figure out what is at the root of this terrorism. Because there is something at the root besides, you know, irrational, murderous feeling. And yes, this was murderous, fanatical feeling. But these were not simply madmen who just, you know, there are people like who just go berserk and kill everybody in sight, right? We know that because we've seen that in our country. Somebody just, something goes haywire in them and they just go wild and it's not that. Terrorism is not that sort of thing. There's something underneath that fanaticism which may have a core of truth to it. That is, there's something in the core of belief of these terrorists which may also be at the core of belief of millions of other people in the world who are not terrorists, who are angry at American policy, but who are not fanatic enough to go and kill Americans because they're angry at our policy, but who are capable of doing that if they are even more aroused, and even if we begin even doing more things to anger them, there's a reservoir of possible terrorists among all those people in the world who have suffered as a result of U.S. foreign policy. Now, I don't know if you think I'm exaggerating when I say there are millions of people in the world who have suffered as a result of U.S. foreign policy. But yes, there are. And Bush, at a recent press conference, said something like, I don't understand why these people hate us. No, I don't, said, we are good. That's what he said. We are good. Look at me. I'm good. Well, sometimes the United States is good. Yes. There are a lot of good things about the United States. And yes, there are times when the United States is good. And then there are times, unfortunately, many times, too many times, when the United States has been bad. Evil, really. And has carried out policies that have resulted in the deaths of, yes, millions of people. And you look at our whole history since World War II. And all the wars we have fought. Wars which were not threats to the national security of the United States, but which in some way suggested to the leaders of our country that there was some geopolitical reason for going into this war. I know they gave other reasons. They said, well, so this country has invaded this country, and we are always on the side of countries that have been invaded. Really? Not so. No. North Korea invades South Korea. Okay, bad. What do we do immediately? Go to war. We're accustomed to that. That's a quick solution. Well, it wasn't a really quick solution. 3 years. 3 years, and then no solution. 3 years, and at the end of 3 years, it's the way it was before the 3 years of war in Korea. That is, you have a dictatorship in the north, you have a dictatorship in the south, only 2 million people are dead. A war that we carried out in Korea with napalm, with atrocities. Of course, it was communist. We were going to stop communism. That was the slogan. Under that slogan, we did a lot of mayhem in the world. Soviet Union was doing mayhem. They were invading Eastern Europe. They were, But using that, we then invaded other countries in the world and spread our military power in other countries in the world and propped up military dictatorships all over the world. And in Central America, we're responsible for setting up, not only propping up, but setting up ruthless dictatorships, which in Guatemala killed perhaps 200,000 people. In Chile, killed a huge number of people. In El Salvador, killed 100,000 or 200,000 people. And then, of course, Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. I mean, those are bad things. And you can't ignore that. And then in the Middle East, and then that's the immediate issue when it comes to terrorism. In the Middle East, what have we done? You know, did we go to war in the Gulf because Iraq invaded Kuwait? Did we go to war because Bush the Elder, because Bush was heartbroken at the invasion of Kuwait, you know? That's not why we go to war. No. I don't like to say this, but we go to war for oil. You know, really, we go to war for oil. We got a war for the control of oil and the control of oil prices. And then we use all sorts of other reasons, you know, oh, well, you know, we're opposed to dictatorship and we're opposed to evil men. And, you know, so we, and Saddam Hussein is, you know, Hitler. You know, Hitler has come in very handy in recent, you know, in all of our wars. Everybody we fight against is Hitler, right? Everybody on our side is Churchill. You know, I remember, you know, I think it was Lyndon, was it? No, it wasn't. Somebody on our side called Diem, the dictator of South Vietnam, our boy, our man in South Vietnam, called Diem at the beginning of the Vietnam War, the Winston Churchill of Southeast Asia. You know, please, you know. But Saddam Hussein, you know, we're against dictators. Saddam Hussein. We're focusing on Saddam Hussein then the way we're focusing on Osama bin Laden now. Got to have somebody to focus on. Remember when we focused on Noriega in Panama? We, if we can only get Noriega, the drug trade. You know, we get Noriega, he's the one. You know, so we get Noriega. The drug trade has multiplied since we got Noriega. You know, but there's this, you know, they think the American people are fools. And sometimes, yes, it's true. You only hope that Abraham Lincoln is right, you know, that you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, not all of the people all of the time, and that after a while people will catch on, you know. So we need to think about this way of combating terrorism. Yes, terrorism has to be combated, but we have to get at the roots of it, and we have to be honest and be willing to look at ourselves and our policies self-critically. Otherwise, we will never learn anything, and we will never get out of this. And if we don't do that, then the Twin Towers will be only the beginning of a succession of blows which we will face, because we will never diminish the amount of hostility there is in the world, and by going to war and bombing people, we'll be increasing the amount of hostility in the world, you see. So, yes. Sure. You know. Oh, people say, yes, but what shall we do? Well, okay. If we can find Osama bin Laden and put him on trial before an international court, that's what you do with criminals. And if he's indeed a criminal, if he is, I know we don't have to try him. Bush says, look, I know he's guilty. You know, maybe he is. Maybe the probability is that he is. But even so, you know, you don't decide, well, the president decided he's guilty, so he's guilty. So we, no. But let's say you find him, put him up on trial, have an international tribunal, so it's, you know, it's not just, you know, Republicans and Democrats who are deciding what happens. Find Osama bin Laden. Find 12 other people around Osama bin Laden. What if you do? What if you put them all in jail? Maybe execute them, put them in jail. Who knows? Oh, that ends terrorism? Really? Does that do it? But of course, we're not even doing that. We're not having an international police effort the way you would have if you were looking for a murderer in the United States. It'd be an intensive police effort, intelligence work and secret work, and try to find the murderer. We wouldn't if we suspected that a murderer was hiding out in a neighborhood in the South Bronx. Bomb the South Bronx, you see. We wouldn't do that, you know, because these are our people who live in the South Bronx. Well, they're almost our people because, you know, some of them are immigrants and, you know, and so on. So, So, yes, we sure, you know, okay, we try to carry on a police, you know, not a war, you know. And yes, we can beef up security as much as we can, you know, airports and airplanes and this. But you know that ultimately that will not really safeguard us against terrorism. But you see, we want short-term solutions. We want quick fixes. That's what war is about. You go to war because you want to do something fast. That's what violence is about in general. Use violence because you don't want to wait, because you don't want to work things out. You don't want to use your mind, your intelligence, your wit. You don't want to use those things that a human being is supposed to be especially endowed with, you see. No, you want to, you know, quickly fix something, boom, go to war. The usual consequences of which are bad, you know. So then, you have to think about our policies, and you have to ask, what should we do to change our policies so that we can change the image of the United States in the Middle East and the world? Because the image of the United States is not that of a peaceful nation. We have not been a peaceful nation. And, I mean, we have our troops everywhere in the world. We have military bases, 19 major military bases all over the world. We have naval vessels on every sea in the world, you say. No, we are not a peaceful nation. And so we have to think about what we can do to reshape the image of the United States, not just for the purposes of having a different image, because this is, you know, this is PR and advertising. Let's change our image, but not the reality. You know, no, we have to change the reality of our policy. But when you bring that up, you're treading on very delicate ground, because you're asking us to reverse the policies of 50 years, maybe more than 50 years, maybe 200 years, maybe 500 years, maybe going back to Columbus. I'm serious. I mean, you know, reverse the policies of the marauding white man moving into other parts of the world, you see. That's a very big order. People don't want to deal with big orders, so they'd rather go to war. But no, we have to start dealing with a big order. And even if you can't accomplish it immediately, you have to have that in mind as a goal. And I propose something as a goal. Okay, and it's something that you might, yes, start working on right away. And the goal is to change America's role in the world from being a military superpower to being a moral superpower. You see, that's... Let's get those troops out of Saudi Arabia. Say, oh, but what about oil? Okay. If you want people to die for oil, that's what's happening. People are dying for oil. People died in the Gulf War for oil. 100,000 Iraqis died for oil. Maybe 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of our sanctions for oil. Ever since World War II, American policy in the Middle East has been based on oil, you see. So you have to make a decision. Oh, we might have to cut back. We might have to cut back. You know. So, yes. I mean, there are things we can do right away to start the process. Yeah, remove the troops from Saudi Arabia, which is a very particular grievance of people in the Middle East. Not Osama bin Laden, although obviously it's a grievance for him. He's Saudi Arabian, right? He's a Saudi Arabian nationalist. He is furious about the fact that American troops are in his homeland, the site of holy places, Mecca and Medina, right? But he's not the only one. There are huge numbers of people, you know, in the Middle East who resent the presence of United States troops in that holy land for them. So, yes, withdraw those troops. Yes, stop the sanctions that are killing hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq. Yes. And also be very firm and clear with Israel about you know, it's, you know, and anybody who knows anything at all about that situation, and I'm not just talking about Palestinians or outside, I'm talking about people inside Israel who understand. The people inside Israel, except that they're not in power, the people inside Israel understand so long as they have the occupied territories, there will never be security for Israel. Aside from the fact that it's just a moral failure and a terrible thing that is being done to people. So, yes, the United States has to use the power that it has so far used to arm Israel. Of course, the United States arms Israel, it arms the Arab states, we arm everybody. No, really, we are the big seller of arms in the world. Years later, the arms may be shooting back at us, but we, it's okay, we've made a lot of money in the meantime, you see. So yes, there are things we can do immediately. I guess I'm suggesting that we have to go through a real revolution in our thinking and no longer think of America as needing to be a superpower, really. Think of our country as being a more modest country. You know, Sweden is not worried about terrorists. And, you know, and Denmark and Holland and New Zealand, and there are a lot of places in the world not worried about terrorists. They don't have their troops everywhere. They don't have their naval vessels everywhere. They're not bothering other people. They're not intervening. They don't have a record of massive military destruction and intervention. Yeah, let's be a more modest nation, you see. And if we decide on that, well, then there are all sorts of possibilities that open up, you know, because there are those $350 billion which we've been using to be a military superpower. And can you imagine what we can do with that to help people? To help people in this country, you know, to help people in this country, to help people, yes, to do something about AIDS, you know, to compare the amount of money the United States gives to solve the AIDS problem compared to the amount of money that small, much poorer countries than us give. It's pitiful, you know. No, our, you know, the measure our humanitarian efforts, you know, is, oh, well, we're dropping food on Afghanistan. No, it's, you know, how ridiculous can you be? You know, we have, you know, the food agencies that have been delivering huge amounts of food to Afghanistan by truck say, we can't do that anymore because the bombs are dropping. You know, it's, no. We could use the great wealth that would be made free by our no longer being a super military power to really creating situation in this country of a good society, of free health care for all, of affordable housing for all, of, and helping people in other parts of the world rather than hurting them. So, and then we'll be secure. Bombing is not making us more secure. Do you feel more secure since we started bombing? No. After we started bombing, I saw the congressman scurrying down the steps of the Capitol to get away from, I like cattle, scurrying down the steps of the Capitol to get away from anthrax. It was a strange front page of the New York Times. There the congressman going down the step, quickly down the steps of the Capitol to be, you know. That was a picture on the top of the front page. Below that on the front page was a picture of Afghan refugees fleeing our bombs. I thought of the irony of all of that. Anyway, all I'm suggesting is we need to think for ourselves, investigate for ourselves, use history in a sensible way, appeal to people's good sense, because I think the American people have good sense. You know, I don't believe the 90% figures except as something that will last 5 minutes until people are apprised of three facts and asked two questions, really, because I've seen that happen already, you know. And I've seen people's minds of support for the government change over a period of time, as it did during the Vietnam War, as people learned more about what was really going on. So we have a lot to do. We're all teachers. We're all communicators. We all have contacts. We all have neighbors. We all work someplace. We can all write letters to the editor. We can all talk on talk show programs. We can, you know, organize rallies and, yeah, we can do what was done at other times in American history when it was necessary, particularly during the Vietnam War, but it's necessary, yeah, to build a national movement to say to the government, no, you don't speak for us. You're not doing this for us. You know. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I've talked a long time. Not accustomed to this. That was one of the lies I warned you about. It's yours. It's your Dennis Brutus. You want that? You Dennis Brutus is this remarkable man who came out of the prison with Nelson Mandela in South Africa. Who's been in this country for a while. Who goes back and forth. Who brings a special kind of wisdom from his several worlds to ours. And I thought maybe he wants to say something. Do you, Dennis? Yeah.